From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Dennis Coyce returns home to Wisconsin to head up the Milwaukee Public Museum. Later, a new novel sends young readers to German-occupied Norway at the start of World War II.
The idea that a very powerful force that had been moving across Europe had declared that they were there to protect Norway, neutral Norway, from the Allies. And in the process, they tried to sell that big time.
Our wine contributor says a Napa Valley auction could inspire a smaller scale event here.
There's so many great charities in this market that have started here that built into something that has become a household name, but for one specific cause versus doing something that's a bit broader for the city, for the county, for the state, whatever it might be.
And we'll take a visit to a cheese dinner. Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today. On May 1st, a new era began at the Milwaukee Public Museum when Whitefish Bay native Dennis Coyce returned home to become president and CEO of the institution. Coyce started in the field right here, earning his bachelor's degree in museum design at UW-Milwaukee. He went on to NYU, where he got a master's in museum studies. He's held a variety of positions at art museums around the country, but this appointment is his first at a natural and cultural history museum. Coyce explains to Lake Effect's Bonnie North how his experiences leading contemporary art museums informed this new challenge.
I always wanted to be in the natural history museum world, so I'm excited to be here. But I think the art world itself is a little bit more experimental and willing to take some risks as institutions, particularly the contemporary art side of it, which I was in. And so I think you'll see the public museum think a little more deeply and broadly about what it means to be a museum in this community and how to interface with the community. And there's some real, I think, opportunity in how art museums think about what community means and how to connect people to what they do, which is pretty abstract. And so I think the public museum needs to think about that as well.
Well, give me some examples of what kind of thinking contemporary art museums are doing that maybe natural history museums are not yet.
Well, I can think of two interesting examples. So one might be, how could a natural history museum actually engage with, just to use an obvious example, an artist? There are all kinds of interesting artists out there who are working with our own history, with objects, with sort of scientific specimens, with interests in green issues and global warming. Could you invite some of those artists in to interface with your galleries, with your public, with your collections, and sort of break out of the role that the Natural History Museum is only about dioramas and programs, that you're also about creative interpretation of ideas and transmitting ideas through different cultural mediums. So that might be one example. Another might be, you know, in a more practical sense, the art museum I was last with in Boston, we launched an embedded preschool, which was the first fully embedded preschool at a contemporary art museum in the United States, and got a lot of recognition interest. But we did it because we wanted to think about how young families connect to institutions over their lives. And so those are kids we're going to track at that museum over 10 years, partner up with Harvard's Project Zero. So could the public museum be thinking more deeply about how we connect to families, how we connect audiences, and how we graduate people from their childhood connection and their family connection to an adult connection to how a senior might connect to that museum? I think there's a lot of nuance to how people engage with institutions that the public museum can sort of advance and think about.
Why do you think natural history museums have been slower to the gate in thinking that way? Why do you think art museums have taken the lead on that?
Well, natural history museums have the great advantage of actually being fact-based, right? So art museums take a lot of risks and are interested in that sort of edginess because that's to some degree what contemporary art is about. It's about risk-taking and advancement, sometimes in the absence of facts. You know, the beauty of natural history and natural science and, you know, a museum like NPM is it's based in reality. It's based in factual information. It's based in its collections and scientific data. So there's less room for, sort of fallacies and errors, and we don't want to promote that. But we do want to promote creative use, perhaps, of the collections and the ideas and the facts that stories that collections can tell you. So I think you'll see some of that coming up.
Have the way people used natural history museums in particular changed in the last 20 years, or have they not changed enough?
I think it's both a question of have the audiences changed, which they have, and then have what museums need to do, has that really changed? And I think both those things are true. For our audiences, I think younger audiences in particular now are interested in the stories that museums can tell them, the ways the museums can connect them to the past of who they are, where they are, what the world is about, to the present of their experience and to the future of where they see their own world and their own interests going. So in that sense, I think on a certain level, younger audiences have different expectations of museums. You know, museums like MPM have this incredible history. They came out of a history of collecting the world and bringing it home for everyone to be exposed to, and essentially collecting and cataloging the world for everyone to be exposed to. That mandate is something that, while it still has relevancy and still has generated value for the museum, we have 4.5 million objects, there's great value in that collection. We don't need to go out and collect and catalog the world in the same way. People have access to things that didn't exist when MPM started, like telephones, automobiles, you know, the internet. And so the question of what the museum's role is now and what it needs to be 10, 50, 100 years from now is very different kinds of thinking than the genesis of museums like MPM.
What do you inherit at the Public Museum, both in the positive side of the ledger and in the negative side? And then how do you take that forward?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, what I think we have as a resource at MPM that we can take forward, first of all, is a great community affinity and support of that institution. I've been going around telling folks already in just my first few weeks running some numbers, that museum is the sixth most utilized natural history museum in the United States per capita. So when you take our attendance and divide it by the population, we exceed a lot of really well-known museums. And how many people come and utilize that institution every single year? And that really tells you something about what it means to this community. So I think that's of great import. I think there's a great sense of continuity and history at MPM. It's a museum that both includes natural history and natural science, but also our local history, cultural history, objects, the story of the city. That's a quite unusual reference point for a museum like MPM. Not all natural history museums collected that kind of material. So I think that's a really interesting piece to think about and take forward. On sort of the challenge side, I would put, you know, and maybe it falls onto both the challenge and the opportunity side, the exhibits. So we have this building full of incredible dioramas. I don't know if all Milwaukeeans appreciate just how special those dioramas are. There's nothing like them in the United States to that quality level and that level of detail. The diorama was invented in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Public Museum. The first one was built there. It's still on display. And those dioramas are an incredible historic resource. They're almost historic objects in their own right at this point, both in the positive sense that they're really valuable, in the negative sense perhaps that we have not changed them enough and there hasn't been the resources to change them recently or frequently. But the question of how do you navigate that going forward, I think, will be a really interesting one for the museum.
You also inherit maybe a little bit of public not animosity, but certainly concern about finances. You know, there were all kinds of things that happened before your tenure. Do you think that the museum is in a good position to put that behind it and to tell the public, hey, everything's okay?
It is in a position to put those issues behind it. I think it's in a position to turn a corner and move forward. The museum is now debt-free, or very nearly so. It will be debt-free very shortly. It is in a better financial state than it has been in the last 10 years, and that's thanks in great part to the previous president, Jay Williams, and his predecessor, Dan Finley, for focusing on those core issues. That's not to say that everything is okay, meaning all museums need community support. They need donors. They need funders. They need business support. So the museum, like all museums in this nation, has a real challenge in front of it to raise the resources it needs to transform itself. But we're in a position now, thanks to all that past support, to be ready to transform ourselves and to think about what it means to be a museum again, not just in the sense of staying alive and being sustainable, but in the sense of being visionary and looking ahead to what this city needs and what we could mean to this city. And that's a great place for the museum to be.
So in the short term, what are the first steps that you do to help realize that vision?
Part of it is really thinking about it and communicating out to the community that we're open to partnership and ideas and collaborations. And that's something that we very much are engaged with right now and sort of talking to our communities and what we might do. I think it's about going into a process of thinking big and thinking long term for the museum. And to do that, we need to hear from everyone that is a stakeholder at that museum. So people often talk about strategic plans in the context of museums, which sound very dull and very businessy. But strategic plans, when they're done really well, it's a way to solicit the input from the entire community. everyone of, you know, whether it's geographic diversity, racial diversity, socioeconomic diversity, our employees, our volunteers, our donors, the foundations, the business leaders in this community, we need to get their input on what they need from that museum and what the community sees in it and what its opportunities are. And we need to sort of map that to what we can do uniquely well. You know, we have these resources. We have a collection. We have, you know, exhibits. We have expertise. So how do those two things overlay? What the community needs and what the museum actually has and can provide? And where could we take the museum that will be meaningful for the long-term future of this city and for the museum?
How long do you think that initial process will take you? I mean, you're brand new here, although you are from here, so it's not like you don't know Milwaukee and you don't know the area.
Well,
but it's
I know
been a
Milwaukee
while.
Of 20 years ago. It's been yeah. a while. So I think Milwaukee's come a long way since I was in town, and so I'm learning it afresh, which has been a lot of fun. It will take some time. There's a question of both how do you go through the process of soliciting that input and executing and describing what that plan is, and then how do you communicate that plan out to the community and ensure that everyone agrees that that's where the institution should go? You know, we're truly a public institution. Hence, we need to ensure that our public supports where we want to take that institution. So I envision hopefully we'll undertake strategic planning in the next year and be done with it in the next year and then move on to the phase of communicating that vision and that message out and starting to solicit the support we're going to need and starting to align the institution to do the things that it can do. And that's an exciting opportunity. You know, fundamentally, the museum is going to look very different 10 years from now than it looked 10 years ago. In fact, if we do our job right, it might be almost unrecognizable to what it was 10 years ago. But that difference is what's going to make it exciting, sustainable, meaningful for this community, doing enriching work, leveraging its collections and its knowledge. And that's going to be an exciting change.
Well, while all of that is going on behind the scenes, what's going to be happening for the public face of the museum in the next year? What can the public look forward to seeing?
Well, so we have some exhibits coming up, which are always exciting. There's an exhibit called Aliens and Androids, which is sort of about alien worlds, both off of Earth, but also on Earth, things like deep sea vents and places like that. So we're excited about that. And then next year, there's two major events happening that we're very excited about. The first is the museum's opening its first permanent new exhibit in 20 plus years. It's called Crossroads of Civilization, and essentially is tracking the various components of cultural development across Egypt, across the Mediterranean, sort of how civilization came to be. It'll be a really interesting exhibit that will be here for the long haul, and that's a big achievement for the museum to have gotten to the point where it could reinvest in itself in that way. The other thing that's really exciting, and both for me as a Milwaukeean, a little daunting even perhaps, is the fact that it's the 50th anniversary of the streets of Old Milwaukee in 2015. So I know Milwaukee well enough to know I will be run out of town on a rail if I do anything that wrecks that exhibit. That said, that exhibit needs to be brought up to date and it needs to be recontextualized and it needs to be enriched. And so I think you're going to see us use both maybe a new introduction to that exhibit as well as some really creative technology, very subtle technology, but really creative technology to enrich what that exhibit is and make it new again for people. And I think that could be a lot of fun. So I'm really excited about that.
For all those people who grew up seeing it and yes. have now brought their kids and sometimes grandkids.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's yeah. three generations. I mean, 50 years is a long time for a museum to have one exhibit. It goes back to that opportunity and challenge. You know, people connect to that exhibit. And so there's this great sense of nostalgia. And, you know, I have people say to me all the time, you know, I love the streets of Old Milwaukee, but I'm so tired of that exhibit, but don't ever change it. It's sort of this love-hate, and so we need to figure out a way to renew it and refresh it, but also respect what it is and what it's been and what it means to this community, because it's a great exhibit.
Now, I realize you haven't had time to look at all
4.5 million objects. I'm easily 0.01% into that process.
Okay. What you've seen so far, do you have a favorite piece that you didn't even know you had?
There are two things that I think are really, really, really interesting. One of them I didn't know we had, and I'm not sure what to do about or think about it yet. So I'm still forming an opinion. And that is an oddity that we own, which is we own a beautiful Bruegel painting, which is on loan to the Milwaukee Art Museum, in fact, and has been for a long time. And that is not something that you would typically see a museum like MPM own. So the question is both, why do we have it? What's the story behind it? What do we do with it? What does it mean? So I think that's an interesting piece and just sort of one of those tidbits that you say within 4.5 million objects of a museum you think of as a science institution, there's a Bruegel painting. Who knew? Along with 45,000 other paintings, prints, and drawings. Had no idea. On the flip side of that equation, there are, you know, our great scientific collections. And I think one of the things that I find really interesting, it's a very unique and odd collection, and in the best possible sense of the word, but we have probably the nation's most important collection of historic typewriters, because typewriters were developed in Milwaukee, believe it or not. The first ones were invented here. The first manufacturers were here. And you have this collection that shows not just sort of the mechanics of, you know, what sounds like very dull historic objects, but this was a design problem. It was an engineering problem. How do you make something that humans can use to create words on a piece of paper? It's not a collection that is necessarily easy to tell a super compelling story about. It's something that's completely remote to a 10-year-old now. You know, I mean, they probably haven't even seen a typewriter. So how do you tell that story? I think that's going to be a really interesting collection going forward. And then I'd add one more thing just to make sure that I mix it up with our natural science collections, because we have amazing science and natural history collections as well. You know, we have these incredible fossil collections where we have pieces of rock, including one that's probably 10 by 10 feet that's currently stored in our basement that we're trying to figure out how to get on display, that shows the footprints of dinosaurs running across a sandbar. And, you know, you can see these footprints, and it just makes it so apparent that these were living, breathing creatures. And, you know, to me, it's just a miracle that it exists here in Milwaukee and that we have it and that you can come and see it. And I think that's kind of the magic of a museum like MPM.
Well, Dennis, welcome back to Milwaukee. It is a pleasure to have you back here and also in the studio talking with us today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Dennis Coyce took over as president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum in May. He came to Milwaukee most recently from a position at a museum in Boston. He spoke with Bonnie North. A new novel from a Milwaukee area writer takes young readers to Norway during the German occupation of World War II. We'll hear about it in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Life in a war zone is obviously not an easy situation, but to grow up in such a setting is an even more daunting challenge. Milwaukee area writer Sandy Braille's new novel for middle grade readers tells a coming-of-age tale set in occupied Norway at the start of World War II. Odin's Promise relates the story of Mari, who finds herself growing up and learning about her inner resources as German soldiers patrol the streets of her Norwegian village. Braille is with us in the Lake Effect studio to tell the story of the book. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
What first piqued your interest in the story of the Norwegian resistance during World War II?
Well, I'm not Norwegian to begin with. I have a good friend who is the only child of a Norwegian immigrant and has no relatives at all in this area and wanted to travel back to Norway to meet the people that she already had met in the old days through mail and needed someone to travel with. And it was the best decision I ever made. And on that original trip many years ago, most of her relatives of her generation or older had lived through World War II and the occupation for those long years. And the pictures they showed and the stories they told, I was a writer then, and I knew there had to be something I could do with this. So that was the origin of it.
So that difficult chapter in Norwegian history sounds like it is still alive today over there.
It is. And in fact, the research that I've done over all these years has – and I'm continuing to do now – has revealed that it was something that almost developed a mystique, the extent to which both the organized resistance, the military, and the – secret communications and almost a spy network were organized, have been documented somewhat in movies and in various books. But the day-to-day resistance of people that helped them survive the extremely harsh conditions was not covered as thoroughly. And that really is what kept communities going. And many of those same people had roles in the other aspects of the resistance as well. But virtually every family was involved, and the mystique surrounding that has never faded.
And Odin's Promise is not a true story, but clearly there are many portions of it that are informed by real-life events.
Absolutely. I had started the research, and then in the process of attempting many versions of writing it, got stalled at every point trying to tell the original story that centered around the wedding that had appealed to me. And along the way, over many years, the advice was this really should be like this this whole genre should be a middle grade story. And my characters weren't young people, and I wanted to tell it my way. So despite the fact that I was learning a lot about writing, I was not doing as well as I should have learned to do about taking good advice from knowledgeable people who also write for that age range and said, there's something here you could work on.
Why did they think middle grade fiction was the right genre for this?
Well, my original thought was, if you've ever seen Jan Brett's illustrated picture books, was when I heard the story, this would make such a fabulous picture book for the scenery and the customs and the costumes and everything else. And I used picture books with older readers and thought this would be great. But over the course of time, picture books have changed so radically. If picture books are for older readers now, they are almost entirely more information-based than just the history of this. And for younger readers, it was – the characters were too old. The story was too complex. And so they were looking at aiming up. And in the process of that, it just was perfectly clear that the characters were all adults. If you were going to do anything with it for kids, you needed to – which is what I wanted to do, something that could be read in schools. Along the lines of Snow Treasure by Maria McSwiggan, and that was just a perennial favorite, and others that had been – that I had used with my students. So
you clearly – you introduced a younger character, and you basically tell the story through the eyes of Mari, who mm-hmm. is a middle grade girl herself in this mm-hmm. time.
Yes. But I couldn't find her through all the reason I kept saying no was she wasn't anywhere in my head, and it was the research that brought her to me. A doctoral presentation by someone who is a specialist in Norwegian history and language happened to be published by the University of Wisconsin Press, in fact. And in digging around, I found that, and she had documented journals of people who had lived through those long years, many of whom were adults, but quite a few of whom were really young people. And keeping a journal was at risk to your life as well, because there were raids on homes and everything was searched. And so the young people who had done it really offered me a voice that let me discover their point of view.
And so this essentially becomes both a chronicle of this year in her life and year in the life of this town, but it's also something of a coming of age mm-hmm. story. I mean, she is growing from a little girl or little mm-hmm. one, as she's mm-hmm. referred to, into mm-hmm. someone who really can play a role in mm-hmm. the way things are going in this community.
And surprises herself in the process. The reality that was just beyond her comprehension whatsoever that was confronting her helped her discover things in herself that she didn't realize were there. And she came to some of that self through the partnership with her dog when she had been left to her own devices as her older siblings and parents were busy with more mature lives. So I think she was ready for it when it happened and found that in herself.
And we don't want to give away too many of the twists and turns, but give us a flavor for what life was like in this small village during the German occupation.
Well, this is only the first year, and it continued for many, and things got much, much, much harsher. But in that first year, the invasion occupation was really very similar to the events that we're hearing about in Ukraine and Crimea. The idea that a very powerful force that had been moving across Europe had declared that they were there to protect Norway, neutral Norway, from the Allies. And in the process, they tried to sell that big time.
Propaganda war in many ways.
Oh, totally. And that another thing in this research by Dr. Stoker, she shows many archival posters, and that plays a role in the story too. Posters were up constantly saying Norwegians and Germans are brothers in their genetic making, in fact. So that was hard to hear too, because nobody – there were some who supported the Germans, whether out of belief or because of being having an easier life in the process.
You got more rations.
Absolutely. It was definitely – and benefits with jobs. In that first year already, there were people who lost their jobs. The effects on Jews – and Norway didn't have a large Jewish population, but the effects on the Jewish population were already coming into play. And within a year forward of that, they were – gathered up and exported. And the need for ration cards, the need for secrecy was a major part of it, and not knowing who you could trust, which is truly probably the most challenging part that Mari dealt with and that everyone had to deal with.
Even in a place like school where she has friends mm-hmm. that she's not sure how much she should share with them.
Right. It's one of the first hard lessons she had to learn from her family was you can't believe what you see on the surface, that what no matter what someone says or what you've known about them before. One of the expressions they used was they might be striped, which would mean that depending on who they were facing, they could present the face that would benefit them most. And some kids might have been opposed to the German occupation but had a parent who was going to take what they chatted about at the table and benefit from it.
Why did you choose a smaller town versus setting this somewhere like Oslo or Bergen or Stavanger?
Well, in part because Itre Arne is where I visited, and that's where her family is from. And the setting and not only the physical setting but the community that was there and wrapped itself around the fjord and the size of the community allowed me to find those characters much more readily. In fact, it's such a terrific place because it is so closely related to Bergen. And the train connections, people commute through the train, right, to go over to Bergen. So it allowed me to reflect some things related to why the presence would be so great there, because the Germans didn't occupy every little village and knoll equally. But the access to the fjord, which is actually one of the longest and deepest in Norway and is still used for submarine maneuvers, it's so deep. And all of those things are part of why the Germans were desperately eager to maintain total control of Norway to begin with, and the fact that Bergen and its port was right across the mountain.
Mari and her family have several encounters with some of the occupying soldiers, and again, we don't want to give much away, but you portray them with some nuance. Some of the German soldiers are truly bad or evil, but others less so. Why mm-hmm. did you want to make sure you made some of the German soldiers have some redeeming value to them?
Well, I've thought about that a great deal because it didn't start out with a conscious effort to do that. But that process, too, probably reflects decades of my life in that my father was the son of immigrants from Germany and went to fight in World War II on German soil, which had to have been the most conflicting thing possible, although he, like the rest of that generation, really resisted discussing those things at all until they were quite elderly, and then we lost some of that. So I knew there could be an internal conflict in a soldier, but then I also have lived, as we all have, through more than a decade of ongoing war. And you hear those same stories coming back from our soldiers and recognize that some, I do think, American or not, have had some evil elements to them. The things they've done have been considered atrocities and should be. But others have found in themselves through the process the conflict they feel in wanting to defend us and yet – or be loyal. And there can be other reasons too. How many people join the military because they need the financial security of it? And in Germany, there wasn't much choice. They recruited anyone who had a pulse.
What do you hope your young readers come away with when they finish this book?
Well, first of all, I hope they find themselves doing what I always did as an avid reader, which is just fall into the book. I hope I've written a story that is strong enough that despite it not being a familiar one or something characters and using some language from Norway and situations that they might not recognize, especially the small village, that they nevertheless feel they've been there and they've known her and they care about her. And that's number one for any writer. If I can do that, I can walk away. But on top of that, I really hope it opens the door to them to be able to view things with the same kind of full open mind, to recognize that situations aren't black and white and that no matter what age you are, what I often inscribe for young people is that you are stronger than you think you are. You're always stronger than you think you are. And the question is whether or not you can find that strength.
Sandy Braille, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an honor and a privilege to be here, and I enjoyed it very much.
Milwaukee area writer Sandy Braille's new middle grade novel is called Odin's Promise. It's published by Crispin Books. You'll find a link to more about it and more about Sandy at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We turn to wine and cheese to close the show. First up, wine contributor Ray Pfister when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. $18.7 million is a lot to raise in a single auction, but it was the total raised earlier this month by the Napa Valley Vintners Association in its annual Auction Napa Valley. The yearly event raises money for charities that support the Napa community, which in turn supports some of the top wines in the country and the world. Naturally, our wine contributor Ray Pfister was on hand, and he says the event could provide a model for community fundraising even in a city like Milwaukee. He shared some of the highlights with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce.
Ray, what is it that we're listening to? This is very exciting. It's going very, very fast. But where are we? What are we hearing right now?
Well, this is just one of the 50 lots, count them, 50 lots that were being auctioned that day. And I think this probably was somewhere around number 4 or 5. It goes that fast. It's like bang, 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 bang. From where we were sitting, we're just watching these paddles pop up, and then they, of course, start slowing down, but the bids are still rolling in. That bit of audio, I believe, starts at 10,000 and goes up to 220, I think, when they close it, $220,000.
Now, for our listeners who maybe haven't heard us talk about Auction Napa Valley before, tell us a little bit about this event and why it's important.
Well, it's a yearly event. It's been going on for about 33 years. It started in 1981. John Schaefer was one of the many vintners that started it, as well as Robert Mondavi.
And two big names in the wine world.
Very big names, right. And these are the people who saw people in need that they, from their position, saw that they could help them, that they could, you know, give them a better life. And these are people in their own community. So as I mentioned in the past, auction benefits the hospital in St. Helena. It benefits Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCA, Clinic Olay, which is a free clinic for workers there, all kinds of different charities, including schools. And in fact, one of my interviews, which was with Chef Greg Cole from Cole's Chop House, is where he had the honor of hosting the event where the checks were handed out. And I loved watching him talk about it. He had this big, broad smile on his face, and he goes, wow, this is where we really got to see the money go to work.
Well, let's hear Chef Greg talk about this amazing moment.
I was fortunate enough a couple of years ago at Cole's Chop House, we actually hosted the event where they hand out the money, the proceeds. They hand out the checks. And it was incredible to see that part of it, to see, you know, Clinic Olay, which provides health care to our Hispanic community, getting a check for $1.5 million. For St. Helena Hospital, getting a couple million dollars. I mean, and then lots of local charities like Healthy Moms and Babies and Head Start and all these groups getting, you know, checks that really is much of their operating budget for the entire year. It's incredible. I mean, what this auction does for our community, it really can't be measured.
Again, that was Chef Greg Cole, one of the people you got to interview, Ray, when you were out at Auction Napa Valley. Why is it important for Milwaukee listeners to hear about this event going on half a country away that revolves out of the wine industry, which we usually associate with a lot of wealth and a lot of dollars?
Sure. Well, there certainly is wealth involved in the industry, but any winemaker will tell you it takes us large fortune to make a small fortune in the wine industry. It's not an easy effort to get into. But that aside, my personal feeling for one has been somebody started this, obviously, in Napa, And I really, truly believe that in any community in this country, there is one person or two people or three people who have something like this burning in the back of their heads thinking, what about starting some kind of event that would really benefit an entire community, not just one specific charity? Because there are always so many different people in need in every community. You know, there are people who don't think there are people who are in need in Napa. There definitely are. They're no different than anywhere else. It's just a winemaking community, which, by the way, is a rural community. So I really believe, without getting preachy here, that this could be done. It just takes the right people to come up with this idea and then start forming it. And, of course, this didn't happen overnight. This is, you know, again, 33 years later.
Do you think that Milwaukee has the deep pockets that Napa Valley does that could make an event like that here possible?
I don't think it has to be deep pockets. $18.7 million is what they made off of this year's auction. It was a record. I think $1 million for people in need. I think $500,000 for people in need. Any amount, I think, really, again, is a place to start, and you go from there. It depends on how you do it. And there's so many great charities in this market that have started here that built into something that has become a household name, but for one specific cause versus doing something that's a bit broader for the city, for the county, for the state, whatever it might be.
Well, there were other ways for people who weren't there in Napa at the beginning of June to be involved in this auction. Ray, tell us about those opportunities.
Well, there's three basic parts to the auction, I guess you'd say. First is the barrel auction, where they're auctioning off 10 cases of wine from a barrel made specifically for that event. And the winners are the top 10 bidders for that wine, and you get a case of that wine. So you could be paying $400 for a case, or in some cases, you could be paying $55,000 for that case. Some of the barrel auction items went pretty high. Then there's the e-auction lots, which are completely different. They're not as opulent as the big ones on Saturday, but they're pretty darned amazing with some of the things that they're offering. And that's only online that you can bid for those. Now, there's a new thing they started connected to the barrel auction this year, which was a mobile app. So for me, it was great because I could follow the bidding on my phone as I went around interviewing. The third thing, of course, is the Saturday auction itself, which are these amazing off-the-planet, possibilities, or, you know, 7-day trips to France or whatever, you know, lifetime supply of wine, really incredible stuff.
But like you were saying, there were some smaller lots that were available on the e-auction?
The auction lots went for different prices, and a lot of those lots are a bit more wine-oriented versus trips and travel, that kind of thing. Sherwin Family went for $15,650. Gergich Hills, $12,000. Napa Valley Vintners, which was it was the association lot, which I think would be one I'd love to bet on because you're getting a bottle from just about everybody in the association. That went for $10,000 plus.
I'm surprised that didn't go for more.
Yeah, so was I actually. But again, it's an e-auction thing, so it kind of – you know, the difference with the live auction is you got these two auctioneers, the both of them absolutely kicked butt when it came to waking people up when things got a little slow. The total auction took about 5.5 hours, so it's pretty lengthy for 50 items.
And I would imagine, too, that being at the live auction versus just participating online, there might be a little bit of that factor of wanting to raise your paddle, maybe just being caught up in the moment.
Well, certainly not me, but I think there are a lot of people that do get caught up. And I'll tell you, at the end of the auction, they traditionally do this thing called fund a need, which is it's geared towards kids' charities. That's one of the biggest parts of the whole thing is helping the kids. And they start out with trying to get $500,000, $250,000, you know, that kind of a thing. And these aren't – you're not bidding online. You're just donating. That's what they're looking for, done in an auction fashion. People who've been to auctions are familiar with this thing. And then in the end, they finished it up. They hadn't quite got to the $1,000 price point yet. And they brought up this gentleman on stage. They announced that he was donating $1 million. It was just amazing. The place went crazy. And after all that excitement, after everybody was thinking this is done, wow, $1 million, Fritz stopped and said, wait, we have people out there who want to donate $1,000. They want to put their thumbprint on this auction. And he made a point of getting that, and that was amazing how many people jumped up. This guy, I think, started a real firestorm where people going, well, I want to put something in. You know, I want to put my $1,000 in. If I had $1,000, I would have done it.
Going back to that barrel tasting, what were people saying about the wines that had been specially produced for this event?
Well, everybody's excited about 2012. It's considered the greatest vintage of this particular period of time, and a lot of people are saying the same thing about 13. It's always interesting to talk vintages with a winemaker because their perspective's different. But there were several winemakers saying, I could have left and 2012 would have made itself. It's that great of a vintage. It was because the weather was perfect, the conditions were perfect, they had no problems, no fires, nothing to really cause problems, just enough rain, that sort of thing. Looking back to some of our listeners may remember 2011, especially in Napa, was rain, rain, rain. It was a difficult vintage. Difficult, but not a bad vintage. Half the winemakers I talk to love talking about 2011. This is a hint for you wine lovers out there. Look for that vintage. Read about those winemakers. They loved making that wine. They call it a winemaker's vintage.
Well, and so one of the things I imagine that must have been so interesting for you was getting to talk to these winemakers as they were trying each other's vintages.
What was fun about being at the barrel auction, we ran into Mitch Cosentino, who was not at a barrel this year. He was just there to enjoy. He bought a ticket, and he was there to see his old friends because it's home week for a lot of these guys because they don't get to hang out all the time. They're tied up with harvest. They're out on the road selling. So this is a chance to kind of see a lot of people in one spot. And he was telling me, just going around and tasting all these vintages, like, yeah, everybody did as good as we did with 12. So Mitch has a label called Pure Crew, and he's been in the Valley for a long time. There was a label that he sold with his name some years ago that's still out there, I believe. And he's always a lot of fun to talk to. Very lively character.
This is a spectacular barrel tasting this year. Spectacular. The wines this year are just mind-boggling.
Well, that's,
very exciting.
That's 12, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what it is.
Fabulous. Yeah, because I knew mine were good, but I wanted to make sure I got test taste everybody's. And it is, and I love the difference in styles. I mean, there is producers you never, you know, very rarely heard of that's making great wines. The big name guys are doing great. I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful vintage. And it's a, this has just been a great day.
Again, that was Mitch Cosentino. And so, Ray, you would recommend if we're out in the stores looking for a good bottle, check out 12, check out 13, maybe even try the Vintner's Vintage of 2011.
I would check out 11. I've tried some 11s that really thrilled me. And it's just about that idea of who the winemaker is and what their attitude is. Specifically the smaller makers, those are where you're going to find some pretty tasty 2011s.
Ray Pfister, thank you so much.
Cheers.
Our wine contributor Ray Pfister runs the wine blog and podcast Life Between the Vines. Pfister also owns Fifth Floor Recording in Milwaukee's Third Ward, and he spoke with Stephanie Lecce about Auction Napa Valley. What's for dinner? How about cheese? Just cheese? Really? The story of a cheese dinner when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin is the land of cheese, and so naturally we cheeseheads will often socialize with a plate of cheesy goodness by our sides. But have you ever gone to a social gathering that was solely about artisan cheese, like a cheese dinner? Lake Effect's cheese guru, Jeanette Hurt, says a cheese dinner is just what it sounds like, a dinner focused on cheese, lots and lots of locally sourced artisan cheese. Hurt attended a cheese dinner last year at La Merenda Restaurant in Walker's Point and shares her insights.
At a cheese dinner, the cheese stands center, but it doesn't stand alone. It's not one of those stuff all the cubes of cheese into your mouth with only a few bites of crackers in between kinds of things. When you do get samples, it's not a cheese out. Instead, the cheeses get incorporated into decadent, melt-in-your-mouth masterpieces in unexpected and delightful ways.
We're going to start off with a little taste of all the cheeses before each course, so you can just try the cheese as is. Consider it like an amuse-bouche of cheese. Then you're going to see it how we feel is a fun way to present it in a food format.
Take, for example, La Merenda chef Pete Sandroni's expertly designed first course, a spinach salad made with a cheesy vinaigrette, paired with a Purple Feet wine guy Nate Norfolk's Italian Fiulano. The first cheese, Marica Zacte Borincas, is an American original, meaning there are no European counterparts. It was described as a Gouda that became a Brie, but without the rindy white stuff. As an oozy, meltable cheese, I thought it would probably make a mean grilled cheese sandwich. But in this case, Chef Pete didn't just add the cheese to the salad. He blended the cheese right into the vinaigrette so that it was almost creamy. It was delightful. But like I said, cheese dinners aren't just about the cheese. We also got a taste of Epicurean history as we started digging into our spinach mounds, courtesy of this cheese's namesake maker, Marica Penterman of Holland's Family Farm, based in Thorpe, Wisconsin.
I'm from Holland, from Netherlands, as a cheese hat. In Holland, we are called cheese hats, by the way, too. And a little story behind the cheese hat, Goudas are made in malts, round malts. In the early days in Holland, they were made from wood. And when we would go to war, we would take that wooden mold and we would put it on our head, and that's the reason why we are called cheese heads.
Now, when I first met Penterman, her cheese was already turning heads in dairy circles as her fenugreek Gouda took first place in its category at the U.S. Cheese Championship. 2 years ago, she topped all of her bests, taking first place at that same championship with her aged Gouda. Every time I taste Penterman's ethereal Gouda, I remember watching some bewildered new dairy cows first arriving to her family farm. It's that fresh.
First off, I have to correct myself. Yes, I'm admitting I made a mistake, Dad.
That was followed by another featured cheesemaker, Katie Hedrich of LeClaire Farms in Malone, Wisconsin. A newlywed and only in her 20s, this cheerful wunderkind, Hedrick, is already a cheese force to be reckoned with, and she shows no signs of slowing down.
So many things have been happening that it's kind of amazing. So 2011, about a year and a half after we started making, we won the U.S. Cheese Championship, which was something that we never thought would happen. And then we actually bought another 200 goats to continue to producing the milk. And we actually have the opportunity this year that we will be opening our on-farm retail store. We'll be milking the goats, making the cheese, and then have our on-farm retail store.
I knew that I'd love whatever Chef Pete did with Hedrick's Evalon, a nutty, aged goat cheese. But what I didn't know is how good her Chandoka would be, or where the name came from.
Chandoka is actually the name of my grandparents' farm, which is where we are building our new creamery. So Chandoka stands for Charmaine and Donna and Kathy, which is my grandma and her three sisters. And that cheese actually is a brand new cheese that I've been working on.
The Chandoka cheese bisque was creamy and wonderful, but what stands out from that second course is not the soup, but the rocket baby Chandoka cheese bread that accompanied it.
So tonight's bread that's served with the soup course has also got the same cheese baked right into it.
A buttery, springy, brioche-like creation. This is the bread dreams are made of. And I still, months later, dream of it.
So the Evalon that you guys will be tasting...
Hedrick's Evalon, not an afterthought, starred in a pork loin rouladen with spätzle and a Pinot Noir sauce.
Evalon is actually our signature cheese, and when we were creating this cheese, we wanted something that was really unique. So the Evalon actually is patterned after a Gouda style with a little hint of an Italian finish to it. And so as it ages out, it starts out with some of those Asiago flavors, so the fruitiness to it, and then as it ages out, it becomes more like a Parmesan.
That was followed by Penterman's award-winning aged Gouda with a Palme Dauphine and lamb loin. Needless to say, I was sighing with pleasure as I tasted, and so were the other guests at my dinner table.
Fantastic. I thought I would get tired of cheese by the second or third course, but... there's a lot of versatility.
Well, we're used to selling cheese just pairing it with wine or beer. what Peter did is he actually baked it into something, made it more creative, which we're not used to. We're not that creative. But he did a great job with the soups, with the meats. I mean, it's just a great combination, which is absolutely
from
amazing.
From salad to dessert.
Yeah, especially that salad.
Also sitting at my table was Jen Eady, editor of the new Edible Milwaukee magazine. We had fun riffing on the cheeses, the paired wines, and the courses.
Wow, it's kind of hard to choose what I'm enjoying most, I think. On the one hand, there are so many great stories behind the cheese that we're eating. And just the other thing is just eating them. I mean, I'm a Wisconsinite at heart, and when you do a dinner that's exclusively focused on cheese, you know, you're hitting the right mark, so it's very delicious.
Of course, no good cheese dinner ends without dessert. That's how I got to meet Ron Henningfeld, the cheesemaker at Clock Shadow Creamery, one of the only urban cheese plants in the country. Clock Shadow is known for its sweet curds and fresh cheeses, and perhaps the most interesting of those cheeses is Quark. Quark is sort of like a cross between ricotta and creme fraiche. It's a spreadable, creamy cheese with a little bit of a tart kick, like a cream cheese for grown-ups.
Quark is a European-style cheese, most popular in Central Europe. Quark is the German name on the cheese. It's a fresh cheese, so the sooner you eat the cheese, the better it is. It's a versatile cheese, good for the cooking, the baking, but also good just to eat it plain on crackers or toasted bagel or roll it up in crepes and that sort of thing.
And Chef Pete made a cocoa-dusted cheese souffle, topping it with just a dab of balsamic-laced strawberries. It was light and fluffy and sweet, and I may have just gotten my hands on one extra. At the risk of sounding cheesy, this tart quark souffle made for a sweet and heavenly end to the evening. For Lake Effect, I'm Jeanette Hurt.
Lake Effect contributor Jeanette Hurt went to a cheese dinner designed by La Merenda's chef Pete Sandroni, featuring local Wisconsin cheeses made by Holland's Family Farm, LeClaire Farms, and at Milwaukee's Clock Shadow Creamery. Our segment first aired earlier this month. Jeanette will sign copies of her book, The Cheeses of Wisconsin, a culinary travel guide, this Sunday at the Elegant Farmer in Maquonago. That's the Friday edition of Lake Effect, produced by Stephanie Edom Lecce, Bonnie Winsleydale North, and Dan Munster Harmon, with production support from Cheddar Eleanor Peterson, Colby Brooke Dowden, and Ricotta Audrey Nowakowski. We get web support from Michelle Matternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Couldn't come up with a Gouda nickname. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.